This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The Property Show, presented by boomboom.com for millennials.
Good morning. You're listening to The Property Show on The Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. Last week, China held the second Belt and Road Forum for International Cooperation in Beijing, marking 5 years since it launched the ambitious Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI. Global property consultants Knight Frank recently published their second report on real estate prospects along the BRI, with this year's report titled New Frontiers. Joining me on the show today to discuss the findings of the report is Nicholas Holt, the Asia-Pacific Head of Research for Knight Frank. Could you tell us a little bit about this report?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. The New Frontiers report, this is the second edition. We released our first edition last year. The first report was very much an overview of the whole BRI initiative across the whole of Southeast, Southern, Central, Eastern Europe, Middle East. It covered all the markets, especially where Knight Frank has a footprint. We really focused in on all of those markets. And this year, we've drilled down very specifically into Southeast Asia. But going even deeper, we're looking very much at industrial and logistics markets. So the idea of the report is that we would look at the major infrastructure projects that have happened or not happened under the BRI umbrella across Southeast Asia and how some of these are stimulating in industrial or logistics markets across Southeast Asia, and therefore what are the opportunities, not just in terms of what's happening with China and some of the Southeast Asian countries, but also what the opportunities in a more general sense for real estate occupiers or investors.
And I note that the report has something called the BARI Index?
Yes, interesting acronym, BARI. So actually, it stands for Belt and Road Index. Essentially, this came around, again, in last year's paper, we did it for the first time, because we were speaking to a lot of Chinese investors, developers, corporates, etc., who were a little confused, actually, about a lot of these countries under the Belt and Road umbrella, those who'd signed memorandum of understandings with China, cooperation agreements under the Belt and Road. And they were saying, you know what, we don't actually know too much about, for example, Vietnam, or we don't know too much about Kazakhstan, or we don't know too much about Estonia. You know, some of these countries, they didn't have a sort of a deep understanding. So we thought, well, as a sort of first level of analysis, sort of top line level of analysis, let's look at all of these markets, the ones that have signed cooperation agreements, and let's look at the economic potential. So let's look at GDP per capita, GDP growth, historic and GDP growth projections into the future. Let's look at institutional effectiveness, the rule of law, transparency, all those sort of things. Let's look at demographic advantage, you know, which country has the best population pyramids in terms of their sort of labor force, etc. And then also let's look at the existing infrastructure development. Let's look at market access, how easy it is to enter these markets. And finally, the risk of natural disasters. And we've sort of weighted all of these various factors to provide an assessment of all of the Belt and Road markets. Now, this isn't absolutely comprehensive, but it's a good first-level analysis.
It sounds very comprehensive. Let's turn our attentions to the specific findings in your report. Let's talk about Malaysia. Now, the BARI Index, last year Malaysia was at 6th. Mm-hmm. This year you've placed us at 9th. Maybe talk us through a little bit about what went into the outcome this year.
I mean, the first thing to say is that out of the 67 countries we're assessing, you know, Malaysia's still in the top 10. The reasons why, I suppose, Malaysia went down to 9th position is not so much really a reflection. Well, there's two things. First of all, it's not really a reflection of Malaysia slipping too much. It's more a reflection of three markets actually did very well in terms of their economic potential. So Estonia, Oman and Korea had an upward revision in some of their economic potential, and certainly for Korea in market access. I think in Malaysia, 2018 was a bit of an interesting year. Obviously, we had a lot of political change here. And what we saw is that some of the infrastructure projects were put on hold. So the infrastructure assessment went down slightly. So it suffered slightly from that. Now we're actually seeing some of these projects back on, you know, whether we're talking about the East Coast Rail Line, Rail Link, or the Bandar Malaysia, for example. So I think next year Malaysia could go up again.
I see.
So it's more just an assessment. It's probably actually capturing the sort of the election last year, the sort of slight slowdown, but I think some of that will be corrected in 2019 as we go into 2020.
I'm curious about your perspective. So as you mentioned, after GE14 and after the new government came into power, there was a lot of talk about Malaysia suddenly turning a little bit more antagonistic towards China. And just in the last 2 weeks, we've seen that a lot of these big ticket projects that were put on hold that we thought might be cancelled, they're suddenly being renewed. So was this a surprise to you, or did you think this was like an inevitable outcome in a way?
Well, I think there was a bit of a stock take. This sometimes happens when there's a new government comes in. Okay, so hold on. These deals have been agreed or pledged. Let's have a little look at them a second. And they've actually been renegotiated, really, from the Malaysian side, which I think it's a good move. I mean, ultimately, a lot of Southeast Asian markets, Malaysia included, has that sort of infrastructure gap or deficit. And the Chinese, as you mentioned, you know, in 5 years, how much progress is been made. I mean, I'm staying in Beijing at the moment, and I've seen them build a whole new airport south of Beijing in 3 years. Bang, from 2016 to 2000. I mean, they're very efficient in terms of getting infrastructure done. And where there's a lot of roadblocks and delays, the Chinese are very good at getting this infrastructure done. So it's I think some of it was inevitable given the new government. But hopefully this infrastructure will really benefit Malaysia. That's the key point to make. It's not just the Chinese benefit. It's really for Malaysia's benefit as well. So it's a sort of win-win for both countries.
Right. We saw that for the ECRL project and for the Bandar Malaysia project, you could see that the price tag reduced significantly. How should we interpret these concessions from China? What does China gain from giving in on this?
So I think if we take a step back, what is the BRI all about? Why is China doing this? Well, I think there's a few things. First of all, it's excess capacity. They have, you know, they've built so much infrastructure in China. They've built up this whole industry behind it, and they're running out of infrastructure to build in China. So it's exporting some of that. So that's the first thing. Second of all, it's around building up trade networks with other markets, connectivity with China. Now, we talk about especially Southeast Asia, but the new maritime Silk Road, which is ports, etc., to increase shipping routes into China. And it's also overland as well. So you've got the railway links, etc. So what's in it for China? Well, first of all, it's giving their contractors jobs in third country markets. That's the first thing. Second of all, it's increasing trade. It's actually increasing engagement as well. If you take a sort of bigger thing, this is Chinese engaging with more countries around the world, which obviously is upsetting the status quo to some extent, because, you know, we've had a world order for a while, which hasn't had a China exerting itself or engaging more with the outside world. So, you know, that is changing the status quo slightly. But essentially, it's providing them economic opportunities and connectivity into other markets, new markets for selling their trade, selling their goods and their services. And then obviously for the destination markets, it's really improving the levels of infrastructure, which will benefit domestic economies, companies, as well as helping attract other international investors into these markets.
Okay. Let's talk about the domestic benefits then. What is Knight Frank's outlook on how BRI projects can impact Malaysia?
Well, I think if we look at sort of transport infrastructure especially, and how this can really impact the towns and cities that are suddenly a lot more closely connected in, it can really have a big impact. Suddenly businesses can relook at their supply chains and they're saying, well, hold on, we've got this rail link, and you can look at your sort of labour forces. You can start to sort of assess where businesses can set up. So you could see the East Coast start to attract more investment, again, from other Malaysian investors or perhaps even investors from outside. You're reducing travel time. So again, it's improving the efficiency, I suppose, of Malaysia's economy. What we focused on in this report is really the industrial and logistics, because through things like the East Coast Rail Link, we expect logistics warehousing especially to start to develop along these transport corridors, as, you know, again, the supply chains become more efficient. And again, ultimately, this will benefit businesses, it will benefit consumers, it will benefit Malaysia's economic growth going forward.
Could you highlight maybe some of the locations that you think will be the key epicenters of growth over the next, I suppose, decade or so as a result of this project?
So I think we're talking all along the East Coast. I mean, often when you get these sort of big railway projects, it's where the major stations are, and then around those cities or towns where the train will stop. So I mean, so we're talking obviously Kelantan, where it's starting all the way down to KL and everywhere in between, really, on the major cities or towns. We think these will be the places that will see an uptick in investment, an uptick in activity, and really benefit from that increased connectivity.
What are you going to be keeping tabs on when it comes to BRI projects in Malaysia moving forward?
I think going forward, it will be interesting to see how these projects continue to develop, how on the back of these, we continue to see more trade between China and Malaysia, and also if there are any new projects, starting to come to fruition. Obviously, the big project across overland in Southeast Asia is the Kunming Singapore Railway Link, which actually predates any BRI. This has been talked about for a long, long time, but obviously the Chinese are coming in and really investing in this, certainly in Laos and Thailand. So it'll be interesting to see if that high speed element of that starts being implemented, or discussions around that continue in Malaysia.
I'm speaking to Nicholas Holt, the Asia Pacific Head of Research for Knight Frank. When we return, we'll discuss the impact of BRI across the Southeast Asian region. Stay with us, BFM 89.9.
The Property Show, presented by Boomboom.co for Millennials.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Property Show on The Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. Today, I'm discussing real estate prospects arising from the Belt and Road Initiative with Nicholas Holt, the Asia Pacific Head of Research for Knight Frank. Turning our attention more broadly to the Southeast Asian region, which is the focus of the New Frontiers report, what stands out to you about BRI projects in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, so this year, we focus on Southeast Asia, and we've pulled out four major case studies, one being Malaysia, one being Philippines, one being Cambodia, one being Thailand. And all of these countries, have different, very different sort of dynamics. All have the common thread of having that infrastructure gap, and China being with the Belt and Road being partners on developing some of that infrastructure. All of them are a bit different. All of them have a sort of different angle. I mean, certainly in Cambodia, we focused on the Phnom Penh Sihanoukville highway. Sihanoukville, we've seen a huge amount of Chinese investment going into there. I mean, it really is a focus for them. Over recent years, they're going to also start off the south coast of Cambodia. They're going to start drilling for oil soon. So that's going to be an interesting development, and certainly around those sort of industries, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how China and Cambodia work together. In the Philippines, we've seen sort of some railway links, the deep sea port down in Davao. I think all of this is part of the shipping routes, the Maritime Silk Road. And then Thailand, it's really the Eastern Economic Corridor. It's part of the Kunming Singapore Railway Link. Again, we're seeing more Chinese investment in that economic corridor, along with the high-speed railway link.
So when speaking about the Kunming Singapore Rail, I noticed that Singapore is number one on your list. Mm. What's the reason for that?
Well, I mean, you could question why is Singapore doing in the Belt and Road Index to some extent. I mean, it's actually it was there, and we took a decision last year. They signed a cooperation agreement. They've endorsed the Belt and Road, and we thought, well, to take them out, what's the criteria for taking them out? We would have to take out many other markets if we sort of said, well, we would just don't want to include Singapore. So Singapore's up there. I mean, it really reflects, the growth, the demographic advantage, the institutional effectiveness. It's very, very, scores very highly on that. Market access, it scores very highly on. And infrastructure development, obviously, it's got some of the most advanced infrastructure development of any market. So, I mean, it's almost, I'm not going to say it's a red herring, but it's in there at number one almost as a sort of, as a marker, I guess, for some of the other markets in the BRI. We're not going to see big Chinese investment in Singapore, especially in infrastructure. They don't need it. I think probably what's more interesting is Singapore's role in the BRI going forward. Now, can Singapore position itself to be helping finance, helping provide legal advice, helping do feasibility studies, all these sort of things? Where can Singapore position itself in partnership with China along the Belt and Road? That's going to be interesting.
Very interesting. I don't think I ever really saw that link and how they will benefit from it. A lot of the time it's, well, I think it's also very Western skewed in a sense that the BRI is seen with suspicion. But you're right. I think countries like Singapore could actually stand to gain a lot from BRI.
Yeah.
And I think we can see sort of Japan trying to play that as well. Some people see Japan as a competitor to BRI projects, but at the same time, I think they're also looking to capitalize where they can and cooperate and complement what China is doing.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's so much rhetoric around this. And again, the status quo is being disrupted a little bit, and people feel a little bit uncertain and unsure about how this is all going to play out. And you're right, you know, the Japanese have been investing in infrastructure, obviously sort of through some of the other multilateral banks, you know, ADB, et cetera. ADB have been very much very involved. But now China set up their own multilateral development bank, the AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. So that the Chinese and the Japanese, plus the US, plus others, yeah, they're all competing to some extent in terms of investing across the region. But I do think, you know, ultimately, there is that gap in infrastructure, and where it's financed from, or where it's developed, or who it's developed by. Ultimately, it will be, you know, if Southeast Asian markets and countries benefit from increased infrastructure, it can only be a good thing. And I think just one thing to add here: we talk about the Kunming-Singapore railway link. If that is ever comes to full fruition, and you can really get a high speed train from Kunming all the way to Singapore, they'll have done something that's not been done in Europe. You can't get a high-speed railway across Europe. You have to keep changing. It can be slow. You know, there are bits that are missing. You can't just jump on a train and get from Madrid to Moscow in one go on a high-speed rail link. It doesn't happen. So that increased connectivity, if Southeast Asia can really achieve that, it will be of benefit to, I think, the whole region.
Looking at your regional index and just where Southeast Asian countries are at the moment, where do you think you will see the most progress over the short and medium term?
Interesting. So if we look at Southeast Asia, the absolute potential, a country like Myanmar, you know, we were all very optimistic about Myanmar 2 or 3 years ago. Then there's a bit of a reality check. You know, things are going to be a little bit tougher there. But I think probably in terms of just pure potential, something like Myanmar, a country like that. Now, that's not to say they will fulfill that potential. But if things go well, potentially a country like Myanmar has the potential to rise up that list pretty far. I think Malaysia will stay in and around the top 10. I think, like we talked about, there's a lot of good things going for Malaysia. Vietnam is another market as well that could break into the top 10. It's ranked 13th at the moment. The sort of political relationship, though, between Vietnam and China is not as probably friendly as some of the other markets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think one of the big things is about sort of the, in general, like you say, the 10 ASEAN countries are favourable towards the BRI, but there's also, you know, there is some tensions around certain areas, and certainly in Vietnam there's been some tension. But if Vietnam, certainly on our Barry Index, does have the potential to rise up that list.
On a bigger picture look then, I mean, there's a lot of talk about China investments into countries and the risk of falling into a debt trap. I mean, everyone looks at Sri Lanka and the Hambantota port as a cautionary tale. How big of a risk of these debt traps do you see happening in Southeast Asia with these projects?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's obviously been talked about a lot, the fact that China's taken a 99-year lease as sort of debt repayment that the Sri Lankans couldn't make. And I think, you know, that there has to be I think you put it correctly. It's a cautionary tale. You know, let's just be careful about this. I think there was so much enthusiasm about Belt and Road, fantastic. We'll sign anything, you know. And we would be encouraging from the Chinese side, because also the Chinese could be stuck in situations they don't want to be in, you know. And from the recipient countries, it's really important to do the proper due diligence, analysis, risk assessment before, you know, signing off on any of these projects. So I think it's for something so large and so many projects, to hear of one that, yes, there were some issues here, I don't think that means that the whole thing's a debt trap or the whole thing's, you know, I think that, you know, things have to be carefully analysed. Countries need to be very, you know, take things very seriously and really do the analysis. But I think, you know, there can be, the deals that have been made and the deals that will be made will continue to hopefully provide win-win outcomes, and also, you know, if this due diligence is done and things are carefully thought through, then hopefully the risk of these sort of these issues will be mitigated.
In the little time that we have, what's your overall take on the BRI? How should we view these infrastructure development projects?
The Belt and Road really is, Xi Jinping talked about it as the project of the century. You know, infrastructure investment is generally, you know, it's long lead in times, long development times. And so, you know, these things aren't going to happen straight away. It's part of a huge project which will sort of unfold over decades, I would say. That's the first thing. Second thing, so is Chinese engaging more with the world? So yes, of course, some caution needs to be taken. But in general, I think we should see this as a positive thing, especially now we're seeing that they're paying more attention to international standards, to proper international rules-based way of doing things. I also think it really does provide an opportunity to other countries. So, you know, we talk about, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative, as you know, it's China and the destination country. But actually, a lifting of infrastructure levels provides huge amounts of opportunities for everybody, whether in the domestic market or whether for other overseas investors. You know, if the ECRL comes into fruition, this will provide opportunities for Malaysian investors. It will provide opportunities for other investors along that rail link and even further afield. So I think that's also the way to see it. You know, this is something that can provide benefits to people outside just the two markets in question.
You're a believer in the BRI.
I am a believer. The problem is that rhetoric can take over and everybody thinks it's the best thing in everything in the whole world, and then suddenly things turn against. Oh, it's the worst thing. It's a debt trap. It's awful. You know, be really careful. This is just Chinese imperialism or whatever. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. Like, you know, there are things to be cautious about, things to be careful about, but there's also huge opportunities. And in general, you know, infrastructure development is going to be a positive thing for the markets.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts, Nicholas. I've been speaking to Nicholas Holt, the Asia-Pacific Head of Research for Knight Frank. That's all the time that we have for the Property Show today. Coming up next is the 10 a.m. news bulletin, followed by Enterprise. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9, the business station.
The Property Show, presented by Boomboom.co for millennials. Real estate for real people.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.